words from 1 Corinthians 13. This is St. Paul's great love poem, often used at weddings and celebrations of being together and being in love, where he says, among other things, love is patient and kind, not jealous or boastful, arrogant or rude. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease, and so on. And then he says, when I was a child, I spoke as a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully, even as I've been fully understood. So faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. We mostly spend most of our time thinking about the attributes of love and its effect. But today I want to focus on this little almost sideways insight about childlike wonder. It strikes me that there's a difference between childlike and childish. And Paul says, rightly, when I became an adult, I gave up childish ways. But he also said, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, and I've learned from that. And I wonder if we might learn a little bit more about love, ministry, hope, and joy. If we can recapture something of what it means to be childlike. We were driving home from Austin early this week, and we're listening to one of our favorite singer-songwriters, a guy named Todd Snyder, who you may or may not have heard of. He grew up in Oregon, kind of got his start in the music business in Texas, and now is in Nashville. And he's hysterically funny in some ways. He's also irreverent and, in the same way, rather thought-provoking. Not especially religious, in some respects even anti-church, and in some sense skeptical of religion. But at one point in one of his songs, he quotes this passage. He quotes it briefly, where he says, when I was a child, I spoke as a child. And that's the first part of a couplet in the lyric, and the next eight words are, in effect, a very provocative sermon. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I wish I could remember what I said. And I've been thinking about that all week long. Wish I could remember what I said. I can remember many of the things that I said as a child, the ones especially that got me into trouble, but not much else. So the next best thing, it occurred to me, was to perhaps remember, think about, and learn from things that children have said to me. And since ascending to the throne of grandparenthood about 12 years ago, kids have been saying things to me on and off. And among other things, I thought of these, and I thought of some of the things I've learned from them. Words spoken as a child. Our oldest grandson is 12, and when he was about 5, he and I were doing what granddads do with little boys in the backyard, playing baseball. I was tossing a big ball, and he was hitting it rather successfully most of the time. And he'd hit a few in fair territory, and I'd go get him, and then he hit it in foul territory behind him. And of course, I'm on the other side, and I said, you have to go get that. He said, no, you go get it. You get the ball. I hit him, you get him. I said, no, I get him when they're in fair territory. When they go foul, you get him. He looked at me square in the eye, dropped the bat, and said, I'm done if that's the rule, and walked into the house. I'm going, oh, well. You know, in one sense, that sounds a little almost rude and petulant, but on the other hand, it illustrates a level of what we would now call in lofty terms self-efficacy, and a willingness, it seems, to live with logical consequences. We stopped playing baseball when he decided, I can't continue to do that under these terms. In other words, I will live the life that makes sense to me. That's called self-efficacy. And when it prevents me from doing something I might otherwise continue to enjoy doing, I will live with those consequences. A very mature way of looking at life. And wouldn't it be nice if all of us simply did and said, I know what rules that I need to live by, to live the life that makes sense to me and are helpful to others. And when that costs me something, I will absorb the responsibility for that. I hope he remembers this when he gets into college, because it would be a lesson I would like to reteach some of my college students. Getting on toward what I call the silly season at Texas Tech. Right toward the end of the semester, students are looking at what they've done in the class and some of the things they have failed to do. And there are very clear terms of our relationship in my syllabus. And I tell them on the first day of class, and you know, as I'm explaining what these are, because the university regards these things as an ironclad contract. If I violate the terms of the syllabus with a student, every other student in the class has grounds for a grade appeal. I mean, that's how they look at things. So I tell them on the first day of class, these are the exams. This is when they'll happen. This is the attendance policy and what it might cost you. And you know, mine is sort of unusual, but be that as it may. And then I tell them, I look them in the eye, and I say, look, you don't have to like these rules. You don't have to like the terms of the contract, but you do have to understand them. And if you do, then we'll move forward. And of course, nobody leaves, because I say, and if you don't, this would be a good time to, you know, find another class. It's okay. No problem. Nobody said, I'm done if that's the rule. And yet this week, I've gotten 3 or 4 emails saying to me, I didn't hold up my end of the deal, and now I want you to break your end of the deal so I don't have to pay for that. It would be nice if it were that simple. If, spoken as a child, we understood that if that's the rule, and if we can't live with it, we accept the consequences of that. And, you know, this is the logic behind heroism in some ways, or even martyrdom. But to simply say, I know what I need to be the person I need to be, and when that runs contrary to prevailing values, I will both accept the consequences for that and move on. I'm done if that's the rule, spoken as a child. We were laughing at the reiteration of something Lily said about two and a half years ago. Her dad was working in his chair in his laptop, and he had told her that they would go out and pick some of the peppers in the garden at some point that day. And she's going, it's time to go pick the peppers, you know. And he said, I'm busy doing this. We'll have to do it later. And the words that I didn't hear but have become legend in our family, Lily took a breath, hung her head, and said, I guess I'll have to pick peppers without my pepper picking partner. And simply, you know, just slowly walked out into the backyard. And now it sounds like she's become immediately adept at taking people on guilt trips, but she's only 4, and I don't think at the time, I don't think she was trying to do that. I've been thinking about this because everybody took it to be, oh my gosh, this is the queen of the guilt trip for all of her. And it just isn't. I think Lily was simply saying, I'm going to miss my dad when I do this. That one is less than half of 2, and 2 is greater than twice 1. In other words, like all relationships in a way, there's a third being that you define as the partnership. I try to talk about this when people ask me about marriage and all of that. You remain who you are, each of you. But by choosing to be in a partnership, there's this third being called us that you would be well served when resources are scarce to provide those resources to us, in terms of time and attention, and even material resources, spiritual resources. 1 + 1 = 3 in a partnership. And I think that Lily, as a child, is simply saying, I will miss my pepper-picking partner because us is not doing this. Now, the power of us is extraordinary. You know, you think of the great tandems and partner Martin and Lewis and the other entertaining partnerships and so on. It's also, I think, there's also a deep dark side to it in some ways. I don't think, and this is just me thinking about life as I do as a sociologist, I don't think that the Columbine shooters either alone would have done that. I think that the two of them together interpreting the world as a partnership made that horrible violence happen in ways that it might not have otherwise. Now, on the other hand, I think of the partnership of Nancy and Ronald Reagan. You know, and we've only learned in retrospect how his illness, even toward the latter stages of his being in office, you know, affected who he was and how she was able, by feeding us, to make him continue to be as strong a leader as he turned out to be. So 1 + 1 = 3. 2 > 1/2. 1 < 2. And if we are pepper pickers, metaphorically, we pick them better. It's more fun. It may even be more productive with our pepper picking partners. And when they're not here, we miss them. We're glad when they're back, spoken as a child. In the same trip to the Midwest where I learned Logan was done, if that's the rule, I had another conversation with a kid that lived next door, an older kid. He was 10, 11 at the time. And I only knew his name, and I knew that people thought he was a little weird. Well, we've since learned that he's somewhere on that Asperger autism spectrum, sort of on the low end of it, but he's a little bit different. Wore sunglasses all the time, cloudy, overcast day, and he's just sort of sitting on a rock on the lot line. And I hadn't met him. I just sort of heard about him. And in a lull in the activity, I knew his name, I just said, you know, hi, how you doing? And he put a rock down. He looked up at me through the sunglasses. I had asked him, how you doing? He goes, a better question, who are you? No guile, no sarcasm. He's just, what's your deal? And why are you talking to me? Cracked me up. And I said, well, I'm Logan's papa. And that was about it. But when I said, I'm Logan's papa, that wasn't an answer to the question that was asked. He didn't ask me, what is your relationship to the family next door? And when we hear the question, who are you, we tend to answer it in terms of the labels we wear or the roles we play. Who are you? I'm a grandparent. I'm a spouse. I'm a professor. I'm a minister. Those are not the essence of what we are. Those are the things that we do because of who we are. And spoken as a child, it's a really good question. Who are you? I was thinking about that. I mean, I'm a lot of things. I'm talking about character traits, you know, things that define my essence. You know, I'm confident and egotistical, glib and sarcastic. And most positive character traits that I can think of about me have a couplet where there's a backside. So I think when we understand that the answer to the question, who we are, requires us to do a level of introspection. If we take it seriously, you just blow off the question, Sam Logan's papa, and that's it, you know. But if you take it seriously and ask yourself and then start thinking about who you are with regard to character, well, it takes you to the next level. And you have to ask yourself, am I who I want to be? Sometimes it's hard to answer that question unless you get something of yourself reflected back to you by a child. And I think if a child ever told me in so many words that they thought I was funny or loving or generous, I would trade that for all the Prozac in the world. It would get me out of anything that I needed to move forward from. It would give me the kind of lift that would get me through and to, you know, the next day. Those are the things that I aspire to as much as anything. And then I thought, you know, in a way, Lily did say that in a thank you note she wrote to Jeannie and me just within the last month or so. I even forget what it was that precipitated the note. But she said in the note, and she drew a picture to illustrate, it was like an illustrated book is what it was, you know. And she says, thank you for this, that, and the other thing. She said, I love you. You rock. Well, actually, she said, you roke, R-O-K-E, which I think is you rock in pluperfect subjunctive. But you rock. And I began to believe that we might now and then. Spoken as a child. The next time I need a lift, or I'm trying to figure out the answer to the question, who are you, given what you just did? Or in some way I'm trying to hold up my end to a contract that I previously signed, I might remember that I rock. I will remember what she said. Amen.